This is the second part of a presentation on the City of 10,000 Buddhas, a Chinese Buddhist monastery located at Talmadge, Northern California. I stayed at that monastery twice, last time from January 3rd until January 27th this year. Last time we talked briefly about the Sino-American Buddhist Association, of which the City of 10,000 Buddhas is part. And I did explain the goal of this association, its means to achieve those goals, then its organization, a few things about its members, the funding, the precepts, and the methods of practice. Then after that, I tried to portray the abbot of that monastery and as well the monks and nuns. And then we started talking about the schedule, the daily schedule at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, and I ran out of time, and so I've been asked to continue this presentation and give a follow-up, which I would like to do tonight. I will not continue talking about the schedule because there are other things that might be more interesting. The structure tonight will be a few words on the chant session, and then after that on meditation in general, and then I'd like to answer one question which was brought forward by Linda Carmine last time, and after that please feel free and ask questions, and hopefully I'll be able to time things a little bit better tonight. So let's start out with the chan session. First of all, the history, then the doctrine, and then later on, the practice. Now, the history. Buddhism was brought to China by a monk from southern India called Bodhidharma, and he lived from 470 to 520 AD. And later on, Chan Buddhism was introduced to Japan by Aizai, who lived from 1141 until 1215 AD. Now, the doctrine involved in Chan Buddhism is the Chan school of Buddhism emphasizes meditation as the way to immediate awareness of the ultimate reality, which might be, or which can be translated as enlightenment. Study, worship, etc. are normally necessary, but should they become obstacles, they must be abandoned. Thus, the patriarchs, who are comparable to probably cardinals in the Catholic Church, resorted to apparent sacrilege, for example, tearing up sutras. Sutras are the Buddhist sacred scriptures. And there's a nice short quote that exemplifies that. Vu, which stands for enlightenment, is caught, not taught. Now, I'd like to talk about the practice involved in Chan Buddhism. First of all, there's sitting. Aiming at nothing except sitting is used to stop the mind in the present moment. It must be goalless and objectless. Breath observation is often practiced. And at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, one question in particular is the focus of the meditation. And this question is, who's reverencing the Buddha? And the aim of that is to perceive one's own true nature through exploring one's own identity. Another form of practice within the Chan tradition is the dialogue and the koan, as you might be familiar with this Japanese term. A koan is a paradoxical question or answer that aimed at inducing the student to realize that all conceptualization is wrong and leads him suddenly beyond this to enlightenment. Now, so far, a few preliminary remarks. What was the chant session like at the City of 10,000 Buddhas? First of all, the chant session there lasted this year for 4 weeks. And people would participate in it for a week, 2 weeks at a time. There was one guy, a monk from Thailand, who did the entire 4 weeks.
Does that mean he sat for?
Yes. Uh-huh. You meditate for 4 weeks straight then, or whatever time period of time you choose to do. Our schedule during the chant session was such that we got up at 2:30 in the morning and then started sitting at 3 o'clock, and it was alternating sitting for 1 hour, then 20 minutes walking meditation, walking in a circle around, in a circle, and then another hour of meditation followed by 20 minutes walking. And that rhythm continued until the end of the day, which is midnight. Except for a break at lunchtime, which was from 10:45 until 12 o'clock, and then another break in the afternoon from 20 to 4 until 5 o'clock. So if you figure that out, that means 15 hours of meditation per day if you stick to the schedule. I did less than that. I did about 12 hours per day, and that was already quite a lot. Now, the walking meditation, perhaps a few things on that. You have to imagine yourself sitting there for 1 hour, and after this hour, some parts of your body might start itching, or you feel pain in your back, or pain in your knees, or in your thighs, or wherever. So you're really happy to be able to move around. And so one of the ideas of the walking meditation is to stretch one's limbs. Another idea, though, is, and now you have to go back into the Chinese tradition, in the old Chinese monasteries, there was, of course, no heating. And same thing held true for the City of 10,000 Buddhas. So the building was, from the inside, rather cold. And if you sit for an hour, then you're bound to kind of get chilled after a while. So walking helps to get the blood circulation going. And in addition to that, at the very end of the walking meditation, there's a run. People run one round, and that helps to warm up and then be prepared for the next sit. The light in the meditation hall during the entire period was rather dim, rather dark. I think that has to do with the psychological effect. It helps to meditate in a dark room, as opposed, not really totally pitch dark, but kind of halfway dark. And during the entire chant session, we were asked to stick to silence, except for really necessary things that needed to be said, like whenever there was an emergency or whatever. There's one more thing I should add in terms of heat, no heat in the building. It is a fact that if you sit, and if your sitting is really concentrated, then the body temperature rises. And so the monks and nuns prefer to sit in a room that is not overheated, because otherwise they might fall asleep. Now, this is a little bit personal. I'll just try to explain how the meditation or the chant session was like for myself, and that doesn't mean anything at all. It'd probably be different for everybody in this room or for everybody else. I try to structure this part, and I'll be talking about the effect of meditation on the body, then furthermore the impact on feelings and sensations, and then meditation with regard to the mind, and then meditation on ethical, spiritual, and intellectual subjects. Let's start out with the first part, the impact on the body. First of all, I have to mention one more thing. I sat for 10 days straight in a row, worked for a while, and then meditate for another three days, so it was almost 2 weeks. Now, what happened during those 13 days? First of all, in terms of body, sometimes there was a stillness, a relaxation of the entire body. A very positive feeling. And then, of course, you've got the bodily pain. And as I mentioned earlier, in your thighs, in your knees, in your ankles, in your back, that varies from day to day, from hour to hour. And you can imagine that if somebody sits for a long time, for a number of days in a row, then certain areas of the part get really sensitive and very sore. So it's kind of hard. But it is part of the Buddhist meditation practice not to move. Once you sit in full lotus or in whatever meditation posture you've chosen, then you're asked not to move until the sit is over. So you have to face the pain. And that has to do with their idea that you should become aware of what's going on in your body and just face it the way it is and don't try to change it. And I found after a while that trying to do that really helps to increase and improve the willpower, because you just have to stick it out somehow and wait until the bell is hit and then the sit is over. What else? Along with the meditation goes a very strong awareness for the body and a very strong sensitivity. It's almost as if you can feel your entire body at times. And I know that Westerners normally have a hard time relating to their own body. So in that sense, it has been a rather good experience. Then I mentioned the rise of the body temperature, and like fasting too, meditation has a cleansing effect, not only on your body, but as well on your mind or your mental area. Now, the impact of meditation on feelings and sensation. For me, there was, first of all, a feeling of unity with nature. In particular during nighttime, well, when we always had our walking period or walking meditation, I would go outside and just walk around there and look at the stars and just enjoy the night and enjoy the sounds and all that. And in comparison to what it is usually like or was like, I felt I had a lot intenser relationship to nature overall during that meditation period. And then once in a while there was a great feeling, a very strong feeling of inner joy and peace and serenity and and harmony. And I'm mentioning harmony in particular because my background has been such that I've been more dominated by conflicts and struggle. So that was quite a shift somehow. Then furthermore, very deep understanding and a feeling for silence and stillness, being able to appreciate that, being able to see its full nature, its full value. And then a feeling of being rather concentrated, focused at whatever I was doing, not only focused during the meditation, but as well focused on walking around or focused on eating or whatever activity was involved during the daytime. And due to the separation of the genders there, I felt a lot less sexual distraction in general. And that definitely helped for the meditation. Now, the impact of meditation on the mind. First of all, there was during certain periods a very strong awareness of shortcomings, failures in behavior, whatever, just looking back on certain things I used to do. And it has been very helpful just to see that. And then through this seeing to gradually get rid of it. Other than that, sometimes music pops up in your mind, and that was strange. I haven't experienced that much before. And then colors, patterns, all kind of things like that. Furthermore, things that are related to the past, memories, such as names and places, I wasn't able to remember for years, and all of a sudden I could relate, or I could remember classmates of mine and how they were, their names and their family and all that stuff, you know, you normally don't think about. And then something else which was kind of funny. When I went to Mexico, I learned Spanish, came back, and my mind was really full of Spanish. And French and Spanish, in terms of language and its origin, are really very, very similar. So when I came back from Mexico, my French was almost gone. And it was really a shame. And then all of a sudden, during one of these meditation periods, it was sometime between 9 and 10 o'clock in the morning, all of a sudden my French came back. And I started formulating a letter to a good friend of mine in French, and it was just there again. And so the same thing happened one day later, more or less at the same time. So overall, I think you could say there's a lot better access to one's memory. And perhaps one more thing I could add here is that the monks and nuns do recite an awful lot of stuff by heart, by memory. Sometimes like 50 pages in a row. And I think the only reason they're really able to do that is that they live such a life where silence is important where they can focus on that. Then in terms of future, of course you sit there, and I happen to make a lot of plans ahead in terms of traveling, trying to find out or lay out different routes to Asia, and you know, going through the Soviet Union and going down through Asia, and it would be different every day. And after a while, I just figured, well, those are just plans, and let them be plans, and that's it. And there were plans about future profession and whatever. And one very serious thing, though, is this constant question, constant battle. Should I get involved in this whole thing? Should I eventually become a monk or not? And I do have to admit at this point here that I'm very, very much attracted to the whole thing. And so this subject came up over and over again. Furthermore, there's just the awareness of, being aware that there's a lot of judging, discriminating, criticizing, and, well, once in a while I just was aware of that creates psychological alienation from other people, and that in the end leads to dualism. And the last part in this section is now meditation on ethical, spiritual, and intellectual subjects. Towards the sixth or seventh day of my meditation, I kind of got bored just sitting there and trying to see what happened in my mind. So I started reading, one chapter a day out of this book here, Krishnamurti, Freedom from the Known. It's a book I've really very much treasured so far. And I would take what I've read into the meditation and contemplate on that. And so the subjects were like time as an illusion, then on thinking, the structure of thinking being interpreted as the past, then on violence, death, fear, freedom from authority, relationships. And then what was surprising as well for me was that I had a much better access to the thoughts of Krishnamurti. It was almost as if, I could focus totally on what he said and gained a lot more insight into what he has to say. And I guess that would hold true for any other book you would read during that time. So that's basically all I have to say about the Chan meditation session. And now one more thing about meditation in general. This might be another, perhaps a little bit lengthy. First of all, meditation, Buddhist meditation, I want to stress that. To start out with, the Buddhist teaching, particularly his way of meditation, aims at producing a state of mental health, equilibrium, and tranquility. Now, a definition. Meditation is a mental culture or mental development. And the Buddhist meditation is mental culture in the full sense of the term. It aims at cleansing the mind of impurities and disturbances, such as lustful desires, hatred, ill will, indolence, worries and restlessness, skeptical doubts, and cultivating such qualities as concentration, awareness, intelligence, will, energy, the analytical faculty, confidence, joy, tranquility, leading finally to the attainment of the highest wisdom, which sees the nature of things as they are and realizes the ultimate truth, which is nirvana or enlightenment. Now, in one of the most important discourses given by the Buddha on meditation, he structures things as such. In the first section, he deals with meditation and its impact on the body, and then on feelings and emotions, the mind, and then moral intellectual moral and intellectual subjects. So it's more or less the same structure I have applied to just earlier describing what happened during the Chan session. Now, the first part, meditation connected with the body. An example for that is awareness of breathing in and out. And I'd like to do a small thing with you, a small practice or exercise. Just try to focus for a minute on a focal point which is below your nose and above your upper lips, or your upper lip. And try to be concentrated just on that, and do that for a minute, and close your eyes, and then let me know what your experience was like. Well, the reason I kind of asked you to do this exercise is just to exemplify how generally our mind tends to run away, either into the future or into the past, but you're hardly in the presence. You're hardly at this, in this particular case, at this focal point. So it's due to a lack of concentration and awareness. And so that is part of this particular practice, to develop that kind of concentration, develop to be in the presence, to be right there and nowhere else. Don't have any, as you said, Ray, ideas of thoughts or feelings coming up related to that. Just breathe in and breathe out. Just be that breathing and touching that focal point, of course. The immediate results of the breathing exercise are described to be good for your physical health, for relaxation, for sound sleep, for efficiency in your daily work, and in general, it makes you calm and tranquil. Now, a different exercise from this one, though, is being aware, being mindful of whatever one does during the day, physically or verbally. Things like sitting, standing, eating, walking, talking, just to be aware of what one does. And they stress that one should be fully aware and mindful of the act one performs at every moment. That is to say, one should live in the present moment, in the present action. And then oftentimes people do not generally live in their actions. They're either in the present or in the past. Another example that I found in one of the books, and you can think of thousands of others, is somebody sitting in a restaurant eating and at the same time reading a newspaper. Well, he's distracting himself, and he won't be able to read properly and understand properly what he's reading, nor fully enjoy his meal. So the Buddhists said, do one thing at a time and do it mindfully. Now, the second part, meditation with regard to all sensations or feeling. In this section, the Buddhist norm normally emphasized that whether you have a happy or unhappy feeling or a neutral feeling, just perceive it as it is. Don't try to change it. Be aware, for instance, that your state, the state of your mind, depends very much on your feeling. As an example, if you experience an unhappy, sorrowful sensation, then your state of mind oftentimes is cloudy, hazy, not clear. You might be depressed even. And oftentimes you don't know why you have that kind of unhappy feeling. And so the way to go about this is to learn not to be unhappy about your unhappy feeling, not to be worried about your worries, and to try to see clearly the cause or causes of your unhappiness or whatever it is. And then you will eventually realize how that unhappiness or that feeling will disappear and cease to exist. And the mind with which you're asked to practice this is the mind of a scientist. Just observe your feelings, your sensations. Don't try to change them. And once again, try to see your sensations or try to observe them objectively, and try to see your sensations not as my feeling, my sensation, but rather a sensation, a feeling. And that in the end helps to get detached from the feelings. And
that then in turn explains why oftentimes in the Asian world you can see and observe that people there are much more balanced than they tend to be here. Whenever we have to face a difficult situation or emotional problems, then oftentimes we just get totally upset and carried away and we're lost. And that is not at all the Buddhist philosophy. They're just trying to cope with that. Now, meditation as regards to our minds, one should be fully aware of the fact whenever your mind is passionate or detached, whenever it is overpowered by hatred, ill will, jealousy, or is full of love, compassion, whenever it is deluded or has a clear and right understanding, etc., we must admit that very often we're afraid or ashamed to look at our own minds, and we prefer to avoid at looking at them, at it. One should be bold and sincere and look at one's own mind straightforward. There's no attitude of criticizing or judging or discriminating between right and wrong or good and bad. It is simply observing, watching, examining. When you observe your mind and see its true nature clearly, you become dispassionate with regard to its emotions, sentiments, and states. Thus you become detached and free so that you see things as they are. And that in turn helps to achieve higher states of consciousness and perhaps eventually enlightenment or whatever. And then meditation on ethical, spiritual, and intellectual subjects, according to the Buddhist understanding, all our studies, reading, discussions, conversation, and deliberations on such subjects are included in this meditation. Example, reading and thinking, in my case, for instance, about Krishnamurti. And of course, there are a number of things the Buddhists stress you should read or study, and that has to do with Buddhist doctrine, but I don't want to go into that too much. So that's basically that. Now, Linda Carnine asked last time, what is my motivation for, first of all, going to the city of 10,000 Buddhas, being interested in Buddhism, and doing all these weird things. Now, I had a lot of doubts whether I should present this or not, but I finally thought I'll just go ahead and do it. It's really a personal part of it. Well, you might call this part of the presentation the spiritual adventure or the spiritual journey. My background is such that I was born and raised Lutheran and white, probably lower middle class, whatever. During the age of, or the age period of between 15 and 18 years, I had to deal with a lot of parental problems, rather intense family crisis. And then, of course, there was a lot of personal struggling, too. Personal struggling for understanding. And there was a general despair over the world, its hypocrisy, its violence, its injustice, its exploitation of fellow human beings and nature, conflicts, greed, aggression, etc. And that kind of a state of mind that lasted for quite a while led me to think about suicide a lot. And I never did it,
though, but I guess I was close sometimes. And during those years, I somehow discovered meditation, got into yoga, had a strong interest in Eastern philosophies, Eastern religions, and started reading like the Hindu sacred literature, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and I guess some Buddhist stuff was among that too. And I wasn't attracted to Christianity at that time at all. I think there was just no answer within that part of Christianity I knew about, nothing that had any spiritual value or any spiritual side to it, aspect to it. And then after having graduated from high school, that period was over, and I went kind of into the ordinary life and into the world, I was drafted and later on did my apprenticeship. And so there was a lot of worldly activities. But then later on, during my studies, it was in particular this contrast between having worked for a stockbroker, an American stockbroker in Paris for a while studying at the same time, and then during the same year going to West Africa in the summer for just 6 weeks. And it was this contrast between, let's say, the poverty, the different way of life in West Africa, and stockbroking, which is, for me at least, more or less the symbol of modern day economic system, and it's almost like, a legalized form of gambling. It's a good way to get rich and in a rather short term of time if you're able. Anyways, so that contrast made me pick up meditation again when I came back, and I started doing a lot of reading and books by people like Krishnamurti and then Albert Schweitzer, D.T. Suzuki, who was a famous Zen scholar, and then Roberto Assagioli. He was a psychologist, kind of human psychology. Then Aldous Huxley, Hermann Hesse, Carl Rogers, another psychologist, Erich Fromm, and then the French Jesuit Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, and then lately here in the States, actually up here at Holden, Thomas Merton, and he's been very influential as far as monasticism goes and just the understanding of that. And then while I was still studying and going back from London to Germany, I got pretty much involved in all kind of social and peace issues, like interest in third world countries, and a great deal of interest in the Green Party and such. But then once I had graduated from the business school, a friend of mine recommended a Buddhist place in England where they offer 10-day silent meditation retreats. And so during the summer of 83, I went to one of those retreats, and that was actually the first real exposure to Buddhism. And I enjoyed that retreat a great deal, and that's how my interest in Buddhism actually came about. And that retreat was pretty significant too in terms of meditation, because it was the first time I did sit under instruction. Before that, it was just sitting by myself and trying to figure out things from books and stuff. And then after the business school, I knew exactly I didn't want to go into business, or at least needed a lot of time to think about things and what I wanted to do in the future.
So I decided to take a year off, and then finally ended up here in the States. And part of traveling around the States has been going to different, let's say, spiritual communities, such as a place called the Meditation Mountain in Southern California. That was a rather esoteric and weird place. And then the City of 10,000 Buddhas, so you've heard some of that. Then the San Francisco Zen Center, I stayed there for a week. And then just being exposed to all kind of different Christian denominations, and people somehow know if you're searching, and then they're really eager to convince you, and they try to proselytize. So I've been exposed to the Mormons, to the Seventh-day Adventists, to Lutherans, and to whatever, a whole bunch of different Christian denominations. Perhaps the last thing in this section is that friends have been, not only books have been important, not only going to different places, but as well friends have been important too. Friends with whom I could relate on a really deep level. And it's hard to describe. Somehow there's a mutual understanding, and you feel that almost right away. It's almost as if you can pick out those people in a crowd of 100 people. It's just a mutual attraction, I guess. So, that's that. Well, if you look at it from a mystical point of view, then I think there aren't that many differences. I found, for instance, that the Trappist monastery in Oregon, Rick and I went to, was in its structure and its whole way of life very, very similar to the Chinese Buddhist monastery I went to. And I think in terms of value, ethics, there are a lot of similarities. Like, they stress values like compassion, joy, peace, non-violence, and they really mean it. I think I've made that very clear last time, pointing out to you that vegetarianism is, for most Buddhists, a natural thing, although there are exceptions to that according to geographical areas. If I look at Buddhism and Christianity in general, and then at the different doctrines, then of course there are a lot of differences. But those differences can be overcome. You can learn from both sides. One of the differences, for instance, is that Buddha, who was the founder of Buddhism, was only a teacher, and he never claimed to be other than a human being, just pure and simple. And other teachers, and I guess Christ goes into that, or might be part of that, were either incarnations, were either God or incarnations of God in different forms, or at least inspired by God. And the Buddha claimed no inspiration from any god or external power. He attained or attributed all his realization, attainments, and achievements to human endeavor and human intelligence. And he thinks that a human being, and only a human being, can become a Buddha or an enlightenment being. Every person has the potential within him or herself to become enlightened. And I think there's a difference there between Christianity and Buddhism. Furthermore, there are a few things I can say here. I'll just pick out the most important ones.
There's no dependence on grace. Enlightenment is something you can reach through self-endeavor. You're not dependent on any external or divine power. Right. That's Well, I think. I think what one could say, though, is that within Buddhism, a human being can do a lot to prepare him or herself, to purify oneself, but then enlightenment as such is probably an act of grace, and you can't force that. That's for sure. And there might be another difference there between Christianity and Buddhism, that enlightenment, which is the term in Buddhism, and that term might be comparable to holiness, at least in the term used in the Catholic tradition, monastic tradition. Well, in Buddhism, you can reach enlightenment either in the present or in the future, whereas in the Christian tradition, it's only in the future. It's only in the future that you go into heaven or whatever. Oh, let's see, what else do we have here? There's no sin, because there are no articles of faith in Buddhism. In fact, there's no sin in Buddhism as sin is understood in some religions. The root of all evil is ignorance and false views. That's ignorance is very important to them. Perhaps one more thing, and then I might stop with this here. Buddhism is known to be a really, really tolerant religion. A tolerant religion towards other religions, in the sense that Buddhism has always tried to encompass other religions and to learn from them, and through accepting and living with other religions, more or less supporting the own religion. And, well, if you look back at the Christian history, there's not that much of that, at least in I'm referring to, in particular, to violent acts. And they, well, I found this a number of times. There's no example of persecution or shedding of blood in converting people to Buddhism. So there seemed to be a difference, too. Then perhaps one more thing. Buddhism is considered to be the least dogmatic among the world's religion. The least dogmatic. And there's not one doctrine to which a Buddhist must subscribe on pain of being dismissed from the fold. And I think that is kind of different in Christianity. You've got the articles of faith, and there are certain requirements you have to meet, and it's only then that you can consider yourself a Christian, or you are being considered a Christian. In Buddhism, that is different. So they just say, well, go ahead, do things, start meditating, whatever, and if you gain certain insights, and if you found through experience, through personal experience, that something is true, something that has been laid out in the Buddhist scriptures or wherever, then go ahead and believe it. But it's not like in Christianity where there's a lot of believing or faith in the first place. The Buddha has stressed that from the very beginning onwards in his very first sermon. Believe only that what you can or what you have experienced. No, Buddhism in that sense speaks to everybody, really to everybody. The only distinction they make is
this distinction between, let's say, the monks and nuns, then the novices, the upasikas and upasakas, and then the lay people. But that's about all you have in that area. Other than that, they're open to all nationalities, and there's no such thing as speaking only towards the oppressed. In fact, well, suffering is one of the great parts of Buddhism. Buddha has investigated that very, very much, and the Four Noble Truths actually talk about suffering, the range of suffering. That's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is the cause of suffering, then the cessation of suffering, and then the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. And all that is geared, well, it's geared to everybody, because suffering is part of everybody's life. Yeah, it is. Rebirth and karma. Those are two basic assumptions in Buddhism, but not only in Buddhism, but as well in Hinduism too.
Reincarnation.
Well, the doctrine there is that basically you've got rebirth and karma. Karma is trying to accumulate good deeds in your present lifetime, plus the good or bad deeds, your karma that you've accumulated in your past lives, and then according to that karma, or the karma determines your the rebirth on whatever realm. That might be, you might be reborn as another human being, you might be reborn as an animal, you might be reborn as a enlightenment being or whatever. And so the aim in Buddhism or of Buddhists is to break this cycle of birth and death, of rebirth. And so cultivation, as it is practiced, for instance, at the Chinese Buddhist monastery, is a way to break that cycle of continuous birth and death. And then finally, if you reach enlightenment, then you have managed to break that cycle.